trick to the microphone, which I haven't yet mastered. I don't know how to turn it on. It's a red light.
I think we need John because we're recording. I don't know whether it's been turned on.
Ah, it's on public address. It's recording. It's on.
Thank you. and his rational approach to legal issues. He gave me great encouragement at that early stage of my academic life, and I remain always an admirer, even though at times he and I took different sides on some legal issues. 10 years later, in 1973, I had the honour and good fortune to step into his shoes when Nigel left Oxford to succeed Sir Ian Brettinger as Sir Wilson Professor and Director of the Institute of Ethnology at Cambridge. And I moved, as Vicky has told you, from Cambridge to take up the leadership at Oxford. With a background in classics at Christchurch, where he won the prestigious Chancellor's Prize for Latin verse, and served as a young officer in the Lovett Scouts in the Second World War, Nigel subsequently gained considerable practical experiences of issues related to crime and punishment during an 11-year varied career as a senior civil servant in the Scottish Office. At first, he was in the Department of Health, then Private Secretary to Lord Hume, later Prime Minister to Sir Douglas Hume, and subsequently at the Scottish Home Department, where he worked in several divisions, those responsible for juvenile delinquency, for sentencing of adults, the supervision of released lifers, for the prerogative of mercy, and for mental health. He still found time to complete an external PhD on the Freudian concept of the unconscious at Edinburgh University, and published in 1957 a short history of psychotherapy, a very well regarded piece of work. Nevertheless, he was anxious to escape what he saw as, and I quote, the grim prospect of another 25 years as a civil servant. His opportunity came in 1959, when he was elected by Northern College, Oxford, to what's known as a Willem Gibbon one-year fellowship for civil servants on sabbatical leave. While there, he completed an excellent study of morale of desk workers in the civil service and in private companies. This book, Morale in the Civil Service, was published by Edinburgh University Press in 1961. And he also made a very favourable impression on Herbert Hart through his contribution to one of Hart's seminars on the philosophy of punishment. And he came to the attention of Rupert Cross, which no doubt was to his advantage. The following year, Max Grunewald retired, and an attempt by some traditionalists in the Oxford Law Faculty to abolish the leadership in criminology, the only established post in the subject, was successfully resisted by Hart, Cross, and Tony Honoré. In his interesting memoir, enigmatically entitled A Man Without Loyalties, published in 2003, Nigel Walker very modestly describes his appointment to the leadership, along with the fellowship at Nuffield College, as a stroke of luck. Indeed, I quote, an undeserved appointment. He recognised that the favoured candidate in academic circles had, and was, had been, in his opinion, rightly, Terence Morris of the NSE. But when one considers his own background, the choice was not as odd as it might first have appeared. Nigel Walker, who had undoubtedly made a very good impression of Nuffield, brought to the post the vigour. He was a keen mountaineer, a logical mind, independent judgment, a definite talent for clear exposition, and determination make his mark by building on the contribution to criminology already made by the scholarly work Max Grunewald. Indeed, Grunewald had been one of the first to obtain grants from the Home Office for empirical research under the powers established by the Criminal Justice Act 1948, and had established a nucleus for research team with Sarah McKay in the lead. But Grunewald's group had no institutional standing at all in the university. Nigel Walker made sure that he was soon on top of his new subject, which His well-researched and lucidly prepared lectures in what was called criminal law and penology, Crim and Pen, which Niki undertook, to law and social studies students, formed the basis of his impressive textbook, Crime and Punishment in Britain, published in 1965, only 4 years after he'd taken up the post. He introduced another remarkable teaching first, the establishment of a small student prisoner class, held for 4 weeks in succession, with the same participants in Oxford Prison. Two such four-week classes were held each term, and they proved to be very popular and rewarding part of the Crim and Pen course, and remained going strong until Oxford Prison closed in 1996. Meanwhile, he'd embarked on an ambitious research project, the first fruit of which was the much admired Volume 1 of Crime and Insanity in Britain, published in 1968, for which he was awarded the LLD. This was followed by a second impressive volume, published in 1973, written jointly with Sarah Kay, which analysed the subsequent conduct of a large sum of offenders released from hospital orders. So he really had achieved a great deal by 1973. In 1966, as a means of promoting empirical research and attracting criminologists to work in Oxford, where only the leadership was funded by the university, just one post, Nigel Walker established, with some setting up funds from the Nuffield Foundation, and with the financial support of the Home Office, a small penal research unit known as the PRU, which was housed in three rooms in the depths of the Bodleian Law Library. The indomitable Sarah McKay was its senior research officer. This small unit became a department of the university in 1971 under the auspices of both the law and social studies faculties, and it soon began to carry out pioneer research, such as that of juries, which shed new light on decision making through the technique of studying the reasoning of a shadow jury, which had been proposed and which had heard all the evidence in real cases in court, as well as research on how the police defined and reported crime. It was on this base that, as Nigel's successor to the breach, I was able to get the support necessary to broaden the scope of the PRU into the Centre for Criminological Research, which has now become the thriving Centre for Criminology. The name may have changed, but Nigel Walker proudly and rightly reminded us from time to time that it was he who was the father of the Oxford Centre for Criminology, because he'd laid his foundations by establishing the PRU now 49 years ago. No doubt this will be noted with much gratitude when the Centre celebrates its half century next year.
Is going to be Professor Joel Eigen. Joel is the Charles K. Garner Professor of Sociology at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Principal Honorary Fellow at the University of Melbourne, and I think he'll largely be talking about Nigel's scholarship and the plea of insanity.
In September 1982, I arrived in Cambridge off on my first sabbatical, having just been a recently tenured professor at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which was established in 1787 with an endowment of £200 given by Benjamin Franklin. In America, 1787 is really old. I learned that when I came to Cambridge that there were in fact referred to as one of the newer colleges. I chose to come to the Institute of Criminology for my first sabbatical because of the opportunity to work with Nigel Walker. His epic two-volume Crime and Insanity in England had been placed in my hands, literally, by Marvin Wolfgang, my thesis director at the University of Pennsylvania, because he knew that I had chosen Penn because of my own interest, his interest, in crime in Renaissance Florence. Sometime in undergraduate school, I had become convinced that history and criminology were a natural fit, that rooting around in dusty archival records allows the chance to escape the hold that present conventional wisdom exacts on our ability to imagine alternatives to current thinking and practice. Like countless readers before and after me, Nigel's work was a revelation. The historical sweep he achieved, tracing Western conceptions of culpability and derangement back to Roman law, coupled with an empirical investigation of trials in early modern England, marked a departure from all earlier historical work that had tried to provide a narrative looking into one of society's most intractable dilemmas: how to reconcile the competing sentiments of punishing the morally culpable and protecting the mentally deranged. All earlier treatments of the defense of insanity were traditionally framed by whether the writer was a lawyer or a physician. Medical authors wrote with irritation at the law's reliance on outdated conceptions of the mind. Indeed, the medical community resented lawyers even speaking about psychological damage. And jurists compiled their histories bristling at medical efforts to expand insanity's scope beyond delirium and delusion to include defects in emotional control and volition, the so-called irresistible impulse. Nigel's ability to stand on the margins of this bitter dispute and able to cut through the identifying and sniping between these two professions is possible because, as we say in America, he did not have a horse in the race. He wrote with a refreshingly nonpartisan pen. Thus, he offered a sober, penetrating analysis of the illogical compromises struck between medicine and law that had produced a series of verdicts that were themselves an exercise in self-contradiction. Nigel summarized 200 years of medical legal accommodations with his customary turn of phrase, and I'm quoting here from his conclusion, quote, "The law tries to preserve the fiction that there are only two verdicts, guilty or not guilty. Even a finding that is obviously of a third kind, such as a special verdict of insanity, must be disguised as one or the other. From 1800 to 1883, it was disguised as an acquittal. From 1883 to 1964, it was disguised as a conviction. And now it is again disguised as an acquittal. But one does not solve a dilemma by shifting from horn to horn." Nigel did not suffer from a limited vocabulary, so there must have been a reason why disguise appears in sentence after sentence. So much of this acclaimed volume is geared to getting beneath appearances, revealing the assumptions that had guided conventional histories of the insanity plea. These had featured a reliance on three or four standard trials that supposedly revealed contemporary attitudes about derangement and blame. With the same detachment with which he stood apart from inter-party rivalries separating law and medicine, Nigel introduced his readers to an archival goldmine, verbatim narratives of courtroom testimony given at the Old Bailey from 1673 to 1913, known as the Old Bailey Sessions Papers. Now the embarkation point for anyone in the history of criminal procedure, of patterns of criminality and punishment, of the rise of the advocacy bar, Nigel's discovery of these heretofore unexamined trials allowed him to create an entire field of scholarship, the history of forensic psychiatry. Much like general psychiatry, the forensic contributions of a Henry Maudsley or an Alexander Morrison have been up to this point limited to, and in some ways disguised by, the physician's own self-serving biographies. Nigel's uncovering the courtroom testimony of these eminent physicians enabled a new generation of scholars to compare what mad doctors claimed in print with what they dared to claim or were usually refrained to claim in court. With the publication then of Crime and Insanity in England, Volume 1, a new and intellectually vibrant field of academic scholarship opened up that now sits at the crossroads of the history of medicine, the history of the professions, and the history of cross-examination of the newest arrival of expert witnesses, the mad doctor. As rich as his fame would prove to be, Forensic psychiatry was only part of the canvas, not just where it would stimulate. As I mentioned before, research on the history of the insanity plea traditionally concentrated on several trials heard between 1723 and 1843. These cases were certainly intriguing and colorful. Their verdicts were well known to historians, but few scholars took pains to point out the implications that surrounded the fact that each involved an attack on a king or a prime minister or an assault by a member of the House of Lords. Writing an insightful history of the insanity plea from these trials would be like writing a history of American jurisprudence relative to insanity by relying on the trial of John Hinckley and his verdict. Does that verdict capture American jurisprudence? Where would you even begin to factor out presidential politics, the racial composition of the jury in a richly polarized district of Columbia, the very deep pockets of the defendant's parents who enlisted an army of expert witnesses? Nigel avoided this pitfall by sidestepping the highly charged political cases that people had been using and instead asked questions of his own. How did the testimony and verdicts in trials of the great and the good reflect the far more numerous garden varieties than in trials of their day, especially the preponderance of insanity pleas in trials for theft? Even if that question had dawned on researchers before him, no one could answer this, because no one knew there were any other cases. So enlisting the services of research assistants, not just searched through collating papers surveying 50,000 trials, eventually identified hundreds of cases never scrutinized before, in which the mental condition of the defendant surfaced as a possible exculpatory factor in the defense. Now able to move beyond the familiar few to compute the unfamiliar many, Nigel laid bare the hazard of relying on verdicts in famous trials and their supposedly totemic legal significance. In the process, he demonstrated a complete lack of resonance between the conventionally invoked trials and verdicts and what was actually happening trial by trial, decade by decade, century by century. The disconnect between legal doctrine and courtroom outcome mirrored the chasm that had separated medical text from medical testimony. Quite apart from the caution criminologists have learned to exercise about relying on the pronouncements of jurists to capture legal thought in one age, Nigel's work spoke to a generation of graduate students, and particularly to one graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania. How much quantitative study in the courtroom could provide the means to illuminate what has been called the law in action? How the law works on the streets, in the courts, quite apart from the lofty pronouncements of jurisprudence. Nigel's pioneering empirical work illuminated how lawyers, judges, and most tellingly juries scrutinize the testimony of burgeoning numbers of psychiatrists and examined and cross-examined by the newly ascended defense bar. One book, in fact, only half of a two-volume work, has become the foundational test for any student of the evolution of insanity plea, indeed the evolution of courtroom procedure. And this was the book that Barbara Wolfgang told me I had to read, and it prompted the letter to Nigel years after requesting to come to Cambridge and spend a year completing the survey of trials up to 1913, when the paper ceased publication. I met him in a dearly missed common room in the old institute. He asked me a series of questions, and we all remember how penetrating his questions could be. And after giving what I assumed were palatable answers, he quickly his index finger and said, "Follow me, Joel," and led me up to his office to the top of the stairs at 7 West Road. He opened a closet door and retrieved from the top shelf shoe boxes filled with hundreds of index cards, each containing the year, the case number, and the volume of the trial. The Old Bailey papers. Each card had been subjected to a hole puncher through which he tied a piece of yarn to keep the cards in descending order. I still remain very pleased to remember the yarn and remember this pre-modern technique of organization because I write on it beforehand. I instantly recognized a kindred spirit on striking uneasy truths with technology. And so began a 30-year research project of my own that will end with this year's sabbatical, my last, and with the completion of my last volume in a three-book series on the history of forensic psychiatry. I hope to put the volume dedicated to Nigel in his hands, but it's still gratifying to know that he knew I was working on it when we spoke at a legal history conference in Edinburgh in 2006. Nigel made it all possible by discovering untapped primary materials and by illuminating the many insights these trial narratives offered, by writing so compellingly about the ways in which the law is shaping the insanity plea, as well as medical testimony in the law that the law uses to keep the insanity plea current. Now when graduate students write, and they write often, for help in interpreting the cases that he brought to light, I can pass on the judgments and interpretations he passed on to me. It's gratifying beyond expression to find oneself a conduit for a pioneer's work, pioneer's ideas to reach another generation. His work may be of the past, but it does not reside in the past. I was not always sure I would get to play this role. When I finished my first book, examining the first third of the trials, I was able to locate with his index cards in the shoeboxes tied together with yarn. I asked him if he would write a foreword to the book. With the same generosity of spirit with which he gave me his original case materials, Nigel graciously agreed and sent his comments directly to the publisher. You can understand my trepidation that when Yale sent me the first copy hot off the press, and I tore it open to the beginning and was initially relieved to read the sort of words any of us would be thrilled to read from a mentor. I then turned the page and found his last sentence, Joel Idol's written a millstone of a book. What could I do with a millstone but hang it around my neck and leave it to the town? Crestfallen, I showed it to a colleague of mine in anthropology who read it over, shook her head and said, Joel, he wrote Milestone. I wondered to this day if Nigel suspected I would leap to the wrong conclusion.
Thank you very much. As I wrote in the British Society of Criminology newsletter, many of us were confused by the title that Nigel chose for his informal autobiography, A Man Without Loyalties, A Penologist's Afterthoughts. Nigel may have been without loyalties in the sense that he was always his own man, fiercely independent and always prepared to speak his mind, but he certainly inspired fierce, fond loyalties, especially, I think, amongst those whom he taught. He was a very remarkable teacher. He engaged the class. He made it work. He insisted that students should visit prisons, talk to prisoners if they were going to write about them. Student-prisoner seminars were an important and regular part of the curriculum, I think, through most of his teaching career. And I remember my visits to Grendon as an undergraduate and to Bedford as a postgraduate as very vital steps in my education. All of us here know that he wrote wonderfully thoughtful and wonderfully engaging student-friendly books, Crime and Punishment in Britain, 1965, Sentencing in a Rational Society, 1969, Sentencing Theory, Law and Practice, 1985, Why Punish, 1991, as well as the thoroughly detailed Crime and Insanity in England, 1968. There are a raft of other thought-provoking books on such topics as Dangerous People, 1996, and Aggravation, Mitigation and Mercy, debunker of myths, a stern critic of waffly thinking. For Nigel, evidence mattered, methods were important. When we decided to hold this event, I read to those who studied for the diploma in criminology, or the MPhil in criminology as it became in 1977, under Nigel. I wrote to those for whom we had an address, inviting them to contribute memories, and I have received some marvellous tributes. Just an hour ago, I heard from Kieran Meehan, who wrote of his fond memories of Nigel as an engaging and lively teacher. He wrote, "Nigel was undoubtedly an outstanding figure in the development of criminology as an academic subject, and I feel hugely privileged to have been taught by him." And so say many of us. He earned great respect and great admiration, as Dr. Bronwyn Naylor put it. He knew how to put down the pompous and the arrogant, nearly always politely, and he knew how to encourage the meek. Rita Bird, also writing from Australia, wrote that as a young woman arriving from Australia, she was very nervous at undertaking the MPhil at Cambridge. Nigel was unfailingly kind and generous of spirit. I quote, "He also gave me feedback on my progress, which enhanced my self-confidence. For example," he said, "Greta, you are an anxiety-ridden perfectionist. However, your anxiety does not affect your performance. You're doing very well." I was floating on air after that meeting. She saw Nigel as a wonderful mentor who enabled her to see law in a broad context and to believe that she could contribute to scholarship and policy in a substantive way. Nigel Lefton noted that not only were Nigel's seminars stimulating, but that he was always courteous to his students, no matter how basic the question that was asked. I'm not sure that's entirely true. I've also been told that Nigel sometimes took out his hearing aid when he didn't want to hear anymore. But he was always patient with those who wanted to learn. He did have, I think, a slightly naughty, subtle sense of humour. In retirement, when he got bored with rugby balls driving in his garden from the Lees School, it pleased him very much to offer them to my rugby-playing son. Janet Issels, who I'm really sure, sorry, I didn't check how to pronounce her name, if anyone can tell me if I've got that wrong. Janet Issels?
Issels.
Is it you?
No, I.
Are you her? No, okay. Well, she wrote me a wonderful email remembering Nigel with great affection and respect. And she tells a story about Nigel enjoying talking about a party he was invited to attend Downing Street, being asked by a guest about his profession. When he said he was a penologist, the woman blushed and asked him if that was the equivalent of gynecologist for men. Audrey Cook wrote that he made a huge difference in her life. She described an occasion when Nigel invited Nils Christie to speak. And then, quote, "conducted probably the most interesting discussion that I have ever witnessed, and one that changed my life. It was amazing to sit in a room and follow a conversation until I couldn't follow anymore. I've never had that experience before or since. A wonderful learning for which I am eternally grateful." I liked that picture. Nigel respecting his students and never talking down to them. Judy Sutcliffe wrote from Canada, "the distinct pleasure of being taught by him. He taught me how to think," she said. "I'm in Toronto running a successful consulting practice, thinking every day." I also received a letter from a state attorney in Florida, Catherine Fernandez Rundle, who described Professor Walker as an incredible inspiration who had left an indelible mark. Near her, Dr. Claire Corbett from Brunel University said, "like many others, I had a soft spot for Professor Walker's kindly manner and incisive thinking and writing that had a role in setting me on my subsequent career path." She, like so many, speaks of the clarity of his teaching. Professor Malcolm Davies, who is here today, spoke of Nigel's charm and courtesy, his subtle sense of humour, and his enjoyment of the company of students, even perhaps as the lady dean of discipline, as some of the colleges would call it here in Kings. Neil Johnson is grateful to Nigel for having taken on the Board of Graduate Studies to get him accepted. As a consequence, he says, he became Cambridge University's first non-graduate postgraduate. Vincent Gaetano, now Judge of the European Court of Human Rights and also here today, wrote of his fond memories of Nigel and also noted that he was indebted to Nigel for his career advice. Nigel, I think, always had time for his students. He also earned the huge respect of his colleagues. Professor Juliet Cheetham, also here, can speak for herself should she wish to, wrote to me of how when she arrived as a green and terrified newly appointed lecturer in the Department of Social and Administrative Studies in Oxford, straight from practicing as a probation officer, Nigel was extraordinarily encouraging as he tried to convince her that she had something important to offer as a recent practitioner. Again, I quote, "Nigel used to say we were in the same position. He too had come straight to Oxford without having had any previous academic post. I wasn't totally fooled by this comparison, but touched that he made it. I personally owe Nigel a great debt of gratitude. As a student, I appreciated his strong sense of justice, his tolerance, his encouragement, his wisdom. Later, when he invited me to write with him the second edition of Sentencing Theory, Law and Practice, we had some very fine debates, and he was meticulous in overseeing how we worked. He was a bit of a pedant, and this was really useful, and others also noted this. Professor Andrew Ashworth wrote to me that he benefited greatly from the 8 one-to-one tutorials that Nigel had given him. Again, I quote, his fiercely logical attention to the use of words has, I hope, stayed with me ever since. I agree. His standards were very high, even though, I have to say, he found getting his brain around his new first Apple computer very challenging, insisting for many months on pushing the return bar at the end of every line. I'm very grateful to you, Michael, for your help at that time. I still hope to write the third edition of that book, as Nigel encouraged me to do some 15 years ago. I'm very sorry that I haven't already done it. If I do, it will be dedicated to the memory of a great and incisive teacher and a deeply honourable, wise man. And now, Professor Sir Anthony, Tony was the Wolfson Professor of Criminology from 1984 to 2006, Director of the Institute from 1984 to 1998. Now, Emeritus Wolfson Professor of Criminology at Cambridge, Honorary Professor of Cambridge at Sheffield, and Life Fellow of Fitzwilliam College.
Thank you very much, Nikki. Like many others, I was encouraged by Nigel as a young man, but in a slightly different role than others have so far described. I was a research assistant here in Cambridge until 1968, when I moved to be the first lecturer in criminology at the University of Sheffield. Nigel, of course, was then still a reader at Oxford, and I don't know exactly the year, but sometime between 1968 and his leaving Oxford in 1973, he invited me to give two lectures at Nuffield College on the sociology of imprisonment. And he did this because I had given those lectures in my last year at Cambridge here in 1968. and he had felt that his teaching at Nuffield was lacking, although he was very keen, as you've heard, on getting students to understand prisons. Sociology was never his strong suit. He was very much stronger on philosophy and psychology. And so he asked me to come down from Sheffield, and I did this certainly for a couple of years at Nuffield. And I well remember the really encouraging way in which he helped me as a young teacher to realize that, yes, I actually did have some talents and I should build on what I was teaching. I was still then a very young teacher. So as you've heard, he then moved from Oxford to Cambridge in 1973. It's important to note that transition because, as Roger Hood has made clear, his appointment in Oxford in 1961 could have been regarded and was regarded in some circles as rather controversial. In 1973, however, in what was still the only chair in criminology in the United Kingdom, it's very difficult to realise that that was true, but it was true in 1973. The only chair in criminology in the United Kingdom was at Cambridge. And Nigel applied for it. And certainly, I was of the view that he was the obvious candidate. And I think that that was a widely shared view. So, to move from a position of outsider in 1961 to obvious candidate in 1973 tells you something about Nigel's dedication and the strides he had made during his time at Oxford. I see my job here today as to talk mainly about his time at Cambridge and about his directorship. I should say that he didn't actually want to be the director of the Institute. He was a Wolfson professor from, as you've heard, from 1973 to 1984. But in his autobiography, he records that he tried hard not to be the director when he became professor. But the university persuaded him otherwise, and he was director from 1973 to 1981 when he stood down and persuaded Donald West, who I'm very glad to see here, to be director for the 3 years until a new Wolfson professor might be appointed. So he was Wolfson professor and director, but also during this period he served on a significant number of governmental committees. So he was very much what nowadays we would call a public criminologist, although at that time no one had invented that term. And in the remaining minutes, I want to pay tribute to these two aspects of Nigel's career. To completely understand Nigel's contribution as director of the Institute, you first have to understand some basic facts about British criminology in 1973. The Institute had been established as part of a package in 1959, and the package included the Wolfson Chair. It was all established as a result of an initiative by the then Home Secretary, R.A. Butler. In the early years of its existence, basically during the 1960s and into the early 1970s, there was a very close link between the Institute and the Home Office, as is revealed by some papers now in the Public Record. Working assumption was that the Home Office would regularly provide research funds to the Institute, in exchange for which the Institute would consult with the Home Office about the nature of these research projects. It was inevitable that as criminology developed in other universities, this special relationship between the Institute and the Home Office would come to an end. And in fact, this change occurred during the early time Nigel was director. Of course, that required the Institute to negotiate research support from more diverse sources. But research support from that source was now definitely on a more contingent basis. Meanwhile, the external environment changed radically because of the spread of radical and particularly Marxist thought in the 1970s. It's quite difficult to recall the flavour of those times. Thinking about this, I thought perhaps the easiest way of recalling something of this to you was a particular small incident that occurred here in King's in about 1979, when I came down from Sheffield for one of the Institute's Cropwood conferences, which had been organised by Nigel. In that particular week, I had been struggling to know how to respond to a draft MA dissertation by a student who was strongly committed to an Althusserian version of Marxism and was trying to apply it to criminology. In the King's Bar, just a few yards over there, I met the always friendly Ron Clark, then at the Home Office Research Unit and inventor of the concept of situational crime prevention. Ron kindly asked me how I was doing. I made the mistake of trying to explain about the Althusserian student, but I quickly realised that news about Althusser had not yet reached the Home Office. That was a kind of ideological gulf that was around at that time. It's quite hard to remember and to recall. Nigel's time as director was inevitably strongly shaped by these two important changes to the external environment. It was not easy to respond to. Research funds now had to be more proactively sought, which he did with considerable success, for example, in a study of burglars' decision-making, which was Nigel's brainchild, but for which he recruited Trevor Bent to lead the study. Meanwhile, however, the original close ties between the Institute and the Home Office meant that radical criminologists often regarded the Institute staff as, in Nigel's words in his autobiography, the running dogs of the Home Office, and he himself was regarded, and again I quote, as doubly suspect, because of his background as a Scottish Office civil servant. In short, ideologically based polarisation was much more evident then than it is now. In addition, there were battles to be fought within Cambridge itself, because not everyone yet regarded criminology as a respectable academic subject. A particularly important internal victory that Nigel achieved that time was to fight off an attempt to downgrade the status of the Institute's librarian. In this and other ways, he recognised and consolidated the role of the outstanding research library that Leon Retzelewitz had created in the early days of the Institute. In Nigel's autobiography, there's a particular emphasis on the role he played in the development of teaching during his time at Cambridge. And his role and contribution in teaching was very significant, as you've already heard this afternoon. But there is, I think, some danger that the proper emphasis on teaching might obscure the wider significance of Nigel's decade at the Institute. He steered the Institute, essentially, into the early stages of its modern role as an independent research and teaching institute, building on the crucial foundations that Leon Retzelewitz had. The Institute will be forever in his debt in this regard, and it's fitting that this has been recognised in two particular ways within the Institute, both of which will be evidenced later this afternoon. First, Leon Retzelewitz, in his will, generously provided for a prize to be awarded to completed PhD theses in the Institute, and Leon provided that this should be named after recognition of Nigel's contribution to the Institute. Secondly, in 1997, the Institute began an annual series of public lectures designed as a special event in the Institute's calendar, and it was decided to name these after Nigel in recognition of his contribution. This year, we've arranged for the 18th lecture in the series to be delivered by Professor Peter Reuter, coincide with this special memorial meeting, and as most of you will know, it will occur later this afternoon. I want to close by talking about something a little bit different, but which was also important during Nigel's Cambridge years, because he didn't spend all his time working on his teaching or his research. In those days, governments were rather more inclined than they are now to look to official committees for advice on criminal justice policy. Given Nigel's civil service background and his prominence as a leading criminologist, he was in high demand as a potential member of these committees. So he found himself receiving papers for the Standing Advisory Council on the Penal System, and also for a number of more subject-specific committees, including Lord Butler's Committee on Mentally Disordered Offenders, the Scottish Council on Crime, and the Bridge Working Party on Judicial Studies and Information. Two of these committees, the Scottish Council on Crime and the Butler Committee, considered the topic of the so-called dangerous offender, and Nigel became especially interested in this issue. This interest led directly to a proposal by Nigel that led to the Howard League setting up a committee, an independent committee, chaired by Gene Flood, Principal of Newry, on which Nigel also sat. That committee developed some very interesting proposals which generated significant academic interest at the time. Although Nigel lamented in his autobiography that the report was, quote, too thorough to be influential in policy. I think perhaps a further reason for the lack of immediate policy influence might have been that the political climate of the early 1980s was not receptive to such proposals. And certainly Nigel noted in his book Dangerous People in 1996 that there had been a change in the political climate in the intervening 15 years. That change has, of course, continued, leading to some ill-thought-out provisions in the 2003 Act for relating to imprisonment for public protection. Mistakes of this are now widely recognised. Like Roger Hood, my views on policies for dangerous offenders differed somewhat from Nigel's, but we were always able to discuss these in a very rational way. And I would certainly agree with him that the debates around the Flood Report would offer a sure foundation for reflection on policy and most of what has happened in the subsequent period. The very public role that Nigel adopted by participating in these various committees led to his having a high profile in the media and in Hansard. As Paul Rock showed empirically in his fascinating article on public criminology published last year. A number of people have mentioned the somewhat strange title of Nigel's autobiography, A Man Without Loyalties. Was he a man without loyalties? Actually, no, he wasn't. Among other things, I can certainly attest to his loyalty to the Institute of Criminology. As you've heard, I was appointed as his successor as Wilson Professor of Criminology in 1984, and I also assumed the role of director at that time. He continued to offer me support in those roles during my tenure of them, in much the same way as he had way back when I first met him at Nuffield. But he did not interfere. Well, from all you've heard about him, you wouldn't have expected that he would try to interfere in any policies that I was developing, and he didn't. But he was continually encouraging, and for that I am enormously grateful.
Thank you very much. And finally, for our formal presentations, I'd like to invite Professor Michael Potter to speak. Michael is Professor of Logic in this university. He too came from Oxford to Cambridge, has been a fellow of Fitzwilliam since 1989, and is Nigel Walker's nephew.
I read Sentencing a Rational Society when I was a teenager for no other reason than I thought it was quite cool that my uncle had written a book that was on the shelves in the local bookshop, and so I walked around school ostentatiously with it in my pocket, and if anyone asked, I said, oh yeah, that's by my uncle. I didn't actually know him that well at that stage of my life, because I grew up in Aberdeen and he was by that stage down in Oxford and then Cambridge. But then when I moved to Cambridge in 1989, I had 15 years before he then moved with Sheila back to Edinburgh to be closer to Valerie in retirement. 15 years when we were both in the same town and we met frequently. I used to come here to this hall to lunch with Nigel, and the only condition of getting a free lunch from him was that I had to, after lunch, go and play a game of chess in an octagonal room over there, which was the only place where smoking was allowed, and I had to put up with the cigar smoke. The second thing they did was we went on long walks in Cambridgeshire on Sundays, always the same arrangement. He would buy the sandwiches at Marks and Spencer's, and we did a day walk. And I guess it was those day walks, actually, that were the big formative experience for me. And the other thing we did was he persuaded me to go with him to the Dolomites on a couple of occasions, and he shared with me his love of those amazing mountains, which he had fallen in love with when he was fighting there during the Second World War. So I just want to say a few things about what I have learned from him as an academic, but what I wish I'd learned from him as an academic, much of which are things I only really realised after he died, which is always the way of these things. The first thing is I feel enormously lucky to have had so many opportunities to talk in some detail with someone who served in the Second World War about their experiences, someone capable of reflecting so thoughtfully on them. And I learned a lot about survivor guilt from talking to Nigel. And I think that's something worth our while being aware of, just because he was part of that last generation of people who fought in the war. And I think as academics, we all need to be aware now of how much more homogeneous the experience of departments and SCOs is now. When I started as an academic in any college, there would be a few, by that stage, life fellows who had fought in the war or been in intelligence in the war. They've all now essentially died, and now SCRs and departments consist entirely, or almost entirely, of people who've been career academics all their lives. That's a narrowing of the academic range of reference that I think is a great shame, something we need to think about how to deal with. The second aspect that I learned from him was about career changing. As it happens, I've changed career too. He started in greats at Oxford and then ended up in criminology. I started in maths and ended up in philosophy. Several people today have talked about his gentle encouragement. I can certainly repeat that thought, that he was always gently encouraging to me and always made me feel that things were possible, but also always was quite willing to mention the role that luck plays. And luck has played a part in my career, as I think he admitted it played in his career. But the other thing I think I wish I'd learned from him, from all those walks in Cambridgeshire, was how to teach, how to supervise, how to encourage other academics, because I now realise, looking back on it, how I have had the benefit of several 6-hour-long supervisions from him, where we would take whatever topic it was, quite often to do with things related to criminology, because I had an amateur interest in that. And what I find astonishing looking back is that in all those conversations as we walked through Cambridgeshire, he never, as far as I can recall, ever said, "Look, Michael, I thought a lot more about this than you, and I'm telling you you're wrong." That just wasn't his method. He gently teased out errors, if there were any, and he just seemed always fascinated by where the ideas would go. One particular memory I have is that when Andrew von Hirsch became a fellow of Fitzwilliam College, the next time I went for a walk with Nigel, I was aware that Andrew's views on punishment weren't the same as Nigel's. So I gently prodded Nigel, because I thought I might get some juicy reaction from him. And instead, what I got was the same kind of approach in relation to Andrew's ideas as I'd had in relation to Nigel's. In other words, Nigel was willing to explain to me, as far as he thought he could understand them, what Andrew's views were and what he could recommend about them. He wasn't interested in trashing them. He wasn't going to give me the cheap hit of being able to say, no, you don't need to think them through, I can promise you they're wrong. He helped me to understand Andrew's ideas just as much as he'd helped me to understand his own. In the last few times I went to see Nigel in Edinburgh, he kept on asking me about the book I've been writing for the last few years, which is on ethics and religion in Wittgenstein, which I wouldn't have imagined for the life of me was something that Nigel would have wanted to read, but every time I met him in his last few years, he kept asking about it and saying how much he was looking forward to reading it. I'm really sorry that it's not even finished now, so he's missing.
When Nigel died, you of course had to wonder about how you were going to remember him. He was an atheist. He was no lover of music. We were not going to do the usual sort of memorial service. So this is what we've had. And I hope Nigel would be pleased. If Joe Garner does not have your name on her list, can you make sure that I know that you're here? Because we would like to know who came here today to remember Nigel. Many interesting things, I think, have already been said. The public criminologist of 1973, go back to sentencing in a rational society where he described himself as an economic reductivist. I think that still sounds wonderfully modern, but there you are, that reflects on me rather badly. Are there people here who would like to stand up and just say their own memory of Nigel before we adjourn to the tea room? Because it would be very nice if there were a few comments from anyone else. Yes, please.
When I came down from Stirling University, having completed my first degree in history and sociology, I didn't get a first, so I was very, very surprised when I was invited to be part of the Edinburgh group for 1980. One of the things I would like to say about Nigel is that he was incredibly understanding about people being able to achieve in an academic way. One of the things I want to share with you is that because I was in a private school and didn't achieve very much at school, it was a great sort of privilege for me to be given the chance to study criminology at this university. One of the funny stories would be to tell you about the final exams that I took for the course. Unfortunately, my skills, my writing was particularly good, and Nigel was kind enough to allow me to read my scripts for my final exams to him in his office because they were almost illegible. Something as practical as that was a kind of indication about Nigel's level of tolerance, but also because he was such a wonderful guide in terms of intellectual exploration and teasing out the but being very demanding intellectually about their arguments. What year, surprisingly, Nigel was my supervisor for my MPhil thesis, and he gave me a recommendation to support for a doctoral research assistant post at Queen's University in Ontario, Canada. When I got to Ontario, my circumstances changed for personal reasons, and I ended up in Washington, D.C., working for various research groups around that area, around the Beltway, it's called Washington, on various projects in the prison area, jail industries, and eventually became director for Justice Fellowship, based in Washington, D.C., and director of policy analysis for them, and wrote and published a number of practitioner groups, actually, on restorative justice and development of that whole area. While doing that, the connections to Cambridge were very important because I was able to chair and to be the principal lead in working with Dr. Goldstein, a student at Yale, the Dean of Yale Law School, and also the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And it was only because of my tutoring from Nigel about getting the best minds working on the policy issues that when I explained about my connection with Cambridge and with the Institute, with Nigel in particular, that was very, very key to, can I say, truly opening doors or having credibility about the nature of the work that we were doing in Justice Fellowship. So I would send Nigel drafts to review of the work that we were doing, mostly because people like Dr. Goldstein at Yale was involved in the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Then, of course, that gave great credence to the work that we were doing. And, of course, I welcomed Nigel's comments, naturally, because it was so constructive to the work that we did. So I just want to say to everybody here that, you know, I have a great debt.
As has been mentioned, I was made director when Nigel decided that he didn't want to stretch from his more important academic work. I have to say that I joined the Institute at its very beginning in 1960, and I worked at various degrees of promotion during the whole of my fraternities as professor and directorship of the institute. And of course, especially in the early days, he was a pretty authoritarian boss. When he was replaced by Nigel, I experienced a complete revolution in the sense that Nigel was a friend and supporter, and this came out in various ways. We started off in a way in a good beginning, because with the extraordinary system that is available to more senior academics, one can evaluate each other's published works with a view to obtaining higher degrees. And he did this for me, and I did it for him. So that was perhaps a connection. Another connection was, of course, that we were interested particularly in mental health and psychological matters, as well as general criminological matters. So that gave us a good connection. And as I say, he was extraordinarily supportive. And when I became director, he certainly didn't want to interfere, but he was always supportive of what was going on. And as a matter of fact, there was something of a crisis that occurred, because a student made serious complaints about negligence in regard to examination. He was supposed to be ill, and that wasn't taken into account. It was discovered that this was a totally incorrect assertion, and indeed he was convicted for forging letters and things in support of this. And through this whole crisis, Nigel was, as his usual way, extremely supportive. So I have really great memories of him as a friend, as well as a sort of boss. Thank you.
Thank you. I think perhaps that we ought to stick relatively closely to our timetable. So the current Wilson Professor, if you'd like the last word, and then I will bring our proceedings to an end. But Larry, if you want to have a word. Good.
My name is Lawrence Sherman, and I met Andrew Walker on two occasions. On both occasions, I was one of the finalists for a post at the Institute of Criminology. And I met him prior to the interview. On either occasion, I was offered the post. But as an experimental criminologist, I do not draw any causal inference from those coincidences. In fact, I have nothing but fond memories of his kindness and interest in my own work and the very pleasant conversations that we had. But I think I drew my greatest inspiration from in reading his autobiography, A Man Without Weapons, in which he provided more details about what Professor Hood has already described as somewhat controversial nature, not only of his appointment, but in fact of the continuation of Oxford University supporting post in criminology. In the autobiography, Professor Walker discloses that there was an attempt by some powerful academics to divert the funds from criminology post to some other subject, but that, among others, Professor H.L.A. Hart opposed the move, despite a very powerful critique by one of the senior academics involved of criminology as a subject that was far too balsamic for the university of Oxford. Professor Walker helpfully explains that balsamic means having to do with work comparable to that of blacksmith. Now, I found that very inspiring, because blacksmiths who course, are applied scientists. They apply horseshoes to horses, among other things. They certainly apply the principles of heating metal and affixing it to other objects. And as the inheritor of the program of applied criminology and police management that was founded by Professor Wattles, I have said often that that's exactly what we do, trying to stick science onto professional practice and dealing with crime in a way that will fall off. Thank you very much to all of you for coming today.
I paid before we go to tea, and I had to plan this, and I'm I think it would be appropriate if we all stood for a moment in silence to pay our own tributes to Nigel, and then we'll join. Thank you to the Provost. Thank you for Kings for welcoming us today. Perhaps you'd like to lead us off to tea.
Yes, thank you very much. Tea is in the Chetwynd room, so we go out.